H.G. Wells, The First Men in the Moon, An Introduction to the Modern Library Edition of 2002. Since genre and literature are often supposed to be exclusive categories, many critics, publishers, and even authors, driven by commercialism or snobbery, deny that a work of literary science fiction is science fiction at all, and invent fancy names for it. H.G. Wells was not indulging in such squeamishness when he called his early stories scientific romances. Writing science fiction years before the genre had a name, he was, like a good biologist, simply giving an accurate label to a nondescript, a newly discovered creature. Scientific romance is a proper Linnaean double barrel, genus and species. The word romance, alluding to the tradition of Lucian and Ariosto and Cyrano de Bergerac, links the older imaginative and purely fantastical element of his stories with their speculative and intellectual element, which was without precedent. For Wells was the first writer of real note to write fiction as a scientist, from within science, rather than as an outsider looking on with excitement or complacency or horror at the revelations and implications of the scientific revolution of the 19th century. Percy Shelley saw the beauty science revealed. Mary Shelley saw the moral ambiguity of it. Jules Verne saw it as an endless technological spree. But Wells saw through its eyes. He was the first literary writer to form his mind in the passionate study of science under a great scientist. His year in Thomas Henry Huxley's class in the Normal School of Science in 1884, when modern biology was defining itself and redefining the world, gave him, as he said, his vision of the world. And much of the ambiguity of that vision throughout his writing life is a faithful reflection of the troubled ethic of the discipline. In an 1891 essay, The Rediscovery of the Unique, Wells wrote, "Science is a match that man has just got alight. He thought he was in a room, in moments of devotion, a temple, and that his light would be reflected from and display walls inscribed with wonderful secrets and pillars carved with philosophical systems wrought into harmony. It is a curious sensation, now that the preliminary sputter is over and the flame burns up clear, to see his hands and just a glimpse of himself and the patch he stands on visible, and around him, in place of all that human comfort and beauty he anticipated, darkness still." When he wrote that, the physicist, still happy in Newton's serenely illuminated universe, had not yet discovered their darkness, but the biologists had. It lay all round the match that Darwin struck. All Wells's scientific romances may be read as investigations into the dark immensity revealed by the brilliance of the hypothesis of evolution. He has been scolded for the glaring impossibilities of his stories, their element of irresponsible romance. In The First Men in the Moon, published in 1901, the anti-gravity material, Cavorite, is no more realistic than the dreams, griffins, wings, and balloons that transported earlier moon voyagers. It might as well be a flying carpet. With typical self-deprecation, taken literally by too many critics trained only in the Jamesian forms of subtlety, he said in his preface to Seven Famous Novels that his method was to trick his reader into an unwary concession to some plausible assumption and get on with his story while the illusion holds. Such prestidigitation is a characteristic ploy of science fiction, to make a non-existent entity or impossible premise acceptable, often by scientific-sounding terms such as telepathy, extraterrestrial, Cavorite, FTL speed, and then follow through with a genuinely realistic, logically coherent description of the effects and implications. Of course, the accurate narrative description of the non-existent is a basic device of all fiction. The extension to the impossible is proper to fantasy. But since we seldom know with certainty what is or is not possible, it is a legitimate element of science fiction, too. What if is a question asked by both science fiction and experimental science, and they share their method of answering it. Make a postulate and then carefully observe its consequences. What if we had a device for getting to the moon? Within some 60 years we would, though it wouldn't be Cavorite. What if the moon had an atmosphere? Wells knew that it didn't. What if its inhabitants were a highly intelligent species that had taken their social evolution into their own rather clammy hands? What then? The last of these what-ifs is the big one. Wells's enterprise is considerably larger and riskier than extrapolation from a current technology to a possible future one, Verne's principal tactic. While Verne marvels happily at future mechanical wonders, Wells wonders where the amoral force of evolution may lead us, and, still more presciently, at what the social and moral implications of deliberate rational control of evolution might turn out to be. This is a question that we, 100 years later, watching corporate science blithely alter genetic codes in plants, animals, and human beings, are just beginning to ask. In an 1896 article, Human Evolution, an Artificial Process, Wells was one of the first to envisage Darwinian process as becoming no longer the work of blind chance, but of human management, unnatural selection. A year earlier, in The Time Machine, in the same year in The Island of Dr. Moreau, and 5 years later in The First Men in the Moon, he explored this vision through fiction. In The Time Machine, if the separation of humankind into grim Morlocks and effete Eloi is a deliberate coding of the hierarchy of social class into human genetics, it backfires rather dreadfully, since the aristocrats have ended up as long pork for the working class. The result of the thought experiment in Dr. Moreau is no happier. In the shorthand terms of a pre-Mendelian fiction, the manipulation of evolution by an obsessed scientist is a hideous failure, engendering only monsters. In The First Men in the Moon, the terms of the experiment are different and the outcome is ambiguous. It is not men who are selecting and breeding themselves for various uses and excellences, but alien beings, moon people. There is no doubt at all that the Selenites are rational and practical. As social insects have been shaped by millennia of random selection to fit their tasks perfectly, so the Selenites, through genetic management and by manipulation of fetuses or infants, have deliberately bred and molded themselves to form an efficient, peaceful, harmonious society without poverty or violence. That their highly specialized individual bodies are, to human eyes, grotesque and frightful, reflects more on our prejudices than on their morality. Aesthetically, they are, to us, appalling, but ethically, are they perhaps our superiors? By leaving judgment on this interesting question to two narrators singularly ill-equipped to make any ethical judgment on anything, Wells leaves it ultimately up to the reader. The principal narrator, Bedford, is a venal, self-complacent bungler, ready for anything but good for nothing. Though his brutality, when it breaks out, is disgusting, he is acceptable as a comic hero rather than a villain because he is mostly so incompetent and so unconscious of his incompetence. Alone on the return voyage, he has one moment of cosmic understanding and piercing self-perception. An ass, the son of many generations of asses. But that soon evaporates. Back on Earth, he is quite himself again. The scientist Cavour is good at only one thing, but very good at that. He is almost as specialized as the Selenites. He is as selfless as Bedford is selfish. He simply wanted to know. When he is left alone on the moon, his messages back to Earth are admirable in their intellectual courage. He will observe and record to the bitter end. But he has made a religion of knowledge, setting it above moral values, community, responsibility, and practical consequences. And it is this blind faith that finally betrays and destroys him. Earth's first emissaries to the strange beings who live in the moon are thus themselves deformed, one by ruthless capitalism, the other by ruthless scientism. This is a very dark comedy, harking back to Swift in its indignation, but with a satiric double edge that reaches straight forward from Wells's time to ours. Told in Bedford's breezy, cheerful, bloody-minded style, it is also a thoroughly entertaining story, fast-moving, often funny. It is lifted above mere adventure by intellectual riskiness and complexity, and also by its aesthetic power, which is uneven but in certain scenes unequaled, moments of the most dazzling descriptive intensity. The chapter, A Lunar Morning, might in itself provide an answer to the question, whether asked patronizingly or seriously, why do people read science fiction? My paraphrase of that answer is, in hopes of receiving such writing as this, a ravishingly accurate vision of things unseen, an utterly unexpected yet necessary beauty, revelation as the scientist knows it. The passage is also an answer to Mandarin critics who try to dismiss Wells as ignorant of literary technique and indifferent to aesthetic value. A more careful reader, Darko Suvin, in his essay, Wells as the Turning Point of the Science Fiction Tradition, pointed to the poetic quality of Wells's writing. This poetry is based on a shocking transmutation of scientific into aesthetic cognition, and poets from Eliot to Borges have paid tribute to it. The word shocking is well used. Such a transmutation remains rare enough to take the breath away. Another memorable scene is given us, late in the story, in Cavour's drier voice. His Selenite guide has been showing him babies, confined in jars, from which only the forelimbs protruded, who were being compressed to become machine-minders of a special sort. The extended hand in this highly developed system of technical education is stimulated by irritants and nourished by injection, while the rest of the body is starved. It is quite unreasonable, I know, but such glimpses of the educational methods of these beings affect me disagreeably. I hope, however, that may pass off, and I may be able to see more of this aspect of their wonderful social order. That wretched-looking hand tentacle sticking out of its jar seemed to have a sort of limp appeal for lost possibilities. It haunts me still, although, of course, it is really in the end a far more humane proceeding than our earthly method of leaving children to grow into human beings and then making machines of them. This fiercely ironic passage puts in question the whole issue of what is so euphemistically called the division of labor, by showing how it can most economically be achieved. Anyone who has read Aldous Huxley's Brave New World will see what the grandson learned from his grandfather's student. I find Wells's satire both keener and more compassionate than Huxley's. And then there is the Grand Lunar, with his enormous brain, many yards in diameter, looming like a vast inflated bladder out of the blue-lit darkness of the deepest caves of the moon, the image of all but disembodied intellect, the ultimate dream of pure mind. It was great. It was pitiful, Cavour says, prevented by his own prized objectivity from realizing that he is seeing an image of himself, mind isolated, without body, without love, trapped in darkness and the ugliness of hypertrophy. The sleep of reason engenders monsters.